Congratulations! You're listening to Congratulations Pine Tree, the Bay's number one arts and culture podcast, with me, Kate Rhodes.
And me, Maysoon Wazwaz.
I'm so glad you're back, Maysoon. I'm so overwhelmed with joy that I've forgotten our recording equipment, and so we're recording on our field recorder.
Yay!
So since I have the field recorder, we're just going to record in this forest. So Maysoon, since you got back, you went ahead and saw the performance at Yerba Buena Center for the Arts, a much contested and tender place. I feel like every episode we go back and forth from condemning YBCA to celebrating them.
Well, yeah, they have a,
But point is, they had a performance recently, which was Sarah Shelton Man, and I was not there, so please regale me.
It was amazing. It was sort of like a retrospective of Sarah Shelton Mann's work, where she brought, I believe there were 40 other performers involved in this 4.5 hour performance, which was crazy because I don't think anyone knew that it was going to be that long. We were all like, great, we're going to Yerba Buena to go see a performance in the theater. And then it wasn't in the theater, it was in the Forum. And then it wasn't 2 hours long, it was 4.5 hours long. And we were like, holy shit, I called Jimbo like 4 times, be like, I don't know what I'm going to do. You can come and go, but what if I want to stay for the whole time? I don't know. I think I'm just going to just do whatever. I got to figure this one out on my own. And he's like, okay, just do what you need to do. But I was so confused by it and also so excited by the potential. And I feel like it really lived up to the potential. There were a few moments where it felt like an intermission or sort of like a little bit of a quiet, like this is kind of boring moment. So part of this performance was the sort of launch of this new sort of digitization of Sarah's archive, basically sort of all of her videos from like the past 30 years. There were these two screens that came down from the ceiling, two like very large scale projection screens that kind of cut the space in half on a diagonal. And those screens were playing all of this footage from like the 80s onward. There were incredible videos of Keith Hennessy in like drag when he was like in his 20s. It was like so sweet to see some of these performers when they were very young, but still doing this like really incredible work before it was even more, not that it's mainstream, but more commonly known, I guess. So it wasn't like that was boring, but there wasn't like action on stage. It was a very quiet, like everything was dark and it was just these videos going on. So it was very sort of retrospective-y, reflective, reflection-y kind of moment. But really cool nonetheless. Incredible performers like Keith Hennessy, Kim Epifano, Jess Curtis, just a lot of, Kathleen Harmesdorf, who is awesome. There was nudity. They did a lot of restaging of some of her earlier works, which I didn't know offhand because I'm not that familiar with her work. Super energetic, incredible technique. Like some of these dancers were outrageous. They were like doing backflips and all sorts of like, totally nuts. There was a sculpture also in there, this huge ice brick hanging from the ceiling with a massive tree branch frozen in the middle of it. So frozen in the middle and sticking out. And it was just melting over time into these like metal buckets on the floor. And that was very peripheral, but it was there the whole time and it was lit the whole time. So it was always sort of in your vision, your line of vision. And then in one quarter, I guess the stage was kind of divided into quadrants and there were different things happening. And then another set court or part of the stage, there was 3 typewriters and there were people who were clearly part of the company or part of the performance who would type, but then also members of the public could also type. And so that kind of gave an audio element. I mean, there was sound other than the typewriting, but the one time I got up to go outside and get a sandwich, because it was 3.5 hours in, and I was like, I think I'm staying for the whole time. I better just like hunker down and get some food here. Because they had really yummy banh mi sandwiches in the hallway, so you could go get them and bring them back in. But I walked by this one typewriter, and because it's sort of like, what are they typing? Because they put headphones on, and you couldn't tell if they were transcribing something or if they were just listening to music and typing whatever they were thinking. And I hadn't really thought to really look at those actions. But I walked by this one guy who was typing, and he had a whole sheet of paper that said Black Lives Matter. Like, the whole sheet was just, like, covered, overlapping text covered in that. But I don't know if everyone was writing that. So it was interesting. It was just a moment of like, oh, I should have been looking at this as well.
Do you think that, was that a member of the audience or a member of the company?
That was a member of the company because he started off, he started at the beginning. He was the one typing for a while. There were two people that were kind of regularly typing, and they'd take breaks, and other people would come and sit down. But he was one of the more regular guys. It was fucking phenomenal. Seriously. It's just one of those things where you're like, this was like this weekend I saw two performances that just were like, fuck yeah. Like really, truly, fuck yeah. I just wanted to be like, well, this is really what I want to do all the time or see all the time.
Two questions. Number one, did Sarah get rid of the secondary spirits?
She did do a spiritual cleanse, I guess you could say, of the audience. There actually early on there was someone who came in with a huge sage brush and like everyone got saged. And then sort of towards the end of the performance, Sarah had her
dowsing rod.
Dowsing rods. It's like a spinning thing.
It's like a metal L-shaped rod, and it spins.
Yeah, and it kind of stops in certain directions based on something that she's asking it or intuiting from it, or I don't know. She did do that.
How did you feel?
She was doing it like across the stage, so she was further away from me than she had been the whole evening. So where I was sitting, she was very close. So like you could feel her presence pretty regularly when she was reading or telling dancers directions as they were performing. When she was doing that, she kind of walked past us and then went across the stage. So she was further away. So I feel like I didn't really get like a... I think if you were sitting near her when she was doing that, you probably would have had a stronger vibration happening.
When I saw her at Counterpulse, that to me was like a hallucinatory experience.
So Counterpulse is also a much, much smaller intimate space. So I could see that being... You know, I could understand that experience for sure. But in this, the forum is like this big gaping open hole, basically. You know what I mean? Yeah, that sounds
totally
weird. But
totally.
It's not, there's no kind of intimacy in that space, really. So I don't know. I didn't.
But it sounds like this was also a very big, a much bigger. And, yes, it was, you know,
huge. And it was incredible.
So appropriate. And you felt like it held the space, yeah. Filled the space.
There was a scene. I just read, there's an article or review on the performances in the Chronicle, the Monday Chronicle this week. It was a very glowing review, obviously. But then there was one moment where the reviewer, I can't remember the name, was just like, Keith Hennessy looked silly in a pink dress and a whip. And I was like, he looked fucking radical in a pink dress and a whip. He did not look silly at all. In fact, every time he used the whip, I was like jumping out of my skin because the whip was fucking long. And you're like, dude, but he had full control over that whip. And there was a saxophonist playing music, like really spazzed out free jazz playing music next to him. And I was convinced that the saxophone was going to get whipped to high heaven by mistake because Keith was just like whoosh, flailing that thing. It was nuts. It was nuts. And every time I was like,
And then my second question is, what was the other performance that you went to?
Oh my God. My other fave.
Is it Constance Hockaday?
Yes, I love Constance Hockaday. Don't you love Constance Hockaday?
Absolutely.
People, listeners, if you don't know Constance Hockaday, please look her up. I have to say.
So what was this piece called?
Oh my God, it was so good. So I love Constance Hockaday so much. This piece is called You Make a Better Wall Than a Window, The Tour. The Tour, bitches. It was so good.
Holy shit, Maystone. Calm down.
I'm just on.
No, I love your passion.
Anyhow, so this one, this tour, this performance took place on a fucking ferry. Hello, San Francisco, Oakland. There are ferries that can take you across the bay, around the bay, from one bridge to the next, people, to the fucking island in the middle. Get on a ferry. It's so good. It's so good.
You're scaring the birds in the forest.
Oh, the birds.
So anyhow, Maysoon, what happened on the ferry?
So it was a tour. You got to the ferry landing over at the SF Ferry building, and there were some SOEX volunteers. You would check out. You got a Clipper card for the ferry ride. You got a headset, and you got a little radio transmitter. Then you get on the ferry, you'd little do your boop boop with the Clipper card, and we go to the very top deck. There were probably 60 people for this particular event. We're on the top deck, lovely, foggy, soupy, rainy day, San Francisco, lovely, cold, everyone's snuggling down. People are so psyched to be there. Everyone wants to be there. It's the best ever. You put your headphones on, you plug it in, the ferry takes off. Connie's the artist, also on the ferry, standing in the corner. She's wearing this great, bright, like neon orange knit cap. And she's basically narrating. She has a script. She's narrating into the headphones, the headsets that we're all wearing. And it's basically this wonderful history, wonderful mix of storytelling, her own experiences growing up on the water, this whole sort of righteous, rightfully so, conversation about who owns the water in San Francisco, all the water politics around land use around with the water. You know, Port of Oakland, Port of San Francisco are the ones that own the water. It's expensive to upkeep, and so they're always looking for ways to sell or to make money off the water, which is why there's the port, which is why there's these fancy condos and developers going in San Francisco. So it's sort of like this mix of like water politics, which was great and so apropos of everything that's happening in the Bay Area, to like sort of historical facts and tidbits about how the port came to be in Oakland. Or it was just a ton of information, but it was so romantic in the way that it was done. You know, like you're sitting on the top deck with the wind blowing and it's fucking freezing, but everyone's together like hunkering down. We're all there because we want to be, and we're listening to the story and we're laughing, and we all have headphones on, so we're laughing. But it's just this weird kind of moment that was so lovely, you know. So the ferry went from San Francisco to Alameda and then to Jack London Square. And at Jack London Square, about like 20 teenagers got on and came up, and they were all like, what the hell? Because we're all like in headphones and like totally look like we're on a tour. It was great. I mean, it was kind of sad that they couldn't also just join in. So there was that element, which was interesting to be confronted with. And then on the ride back to San Francisco, so she had all these, like, there were like these clips from like the 1930s of different people talking about their relationship with the water, like these specific waters.
She like had playback of other audio?
She basically had like a YouTube video that she would hold up to the microphone.
Oh, cool.
That she was using. So it was kind of, it was a little bit janky. I mean, it wasn't like perfect audio technology, but it was perfect. It was perfect in the situation. I wouldn't have wanted it any other way. We had to like turn up our receivers and then turn it back down before she came on, because she like blew out her ears one time. We're like, ah! On the way, like halfway back in to San Francisco, she introduced us to two guys from the Maritime Museum who do the sea shanties on the Belclutha, which is one of the cool old boats. And so we all sang like this beautiful sea shanty coming into San Francisco. It was in like in the pea soup, cold fucking wind. San Francisco is like awesome. It was awesome. I know I said that 15 times. Whatever. I just love those experiences. I love the kind of like art viewing experiences that just make you like, they're like full body experiences. You know what I mean? They're not just like, oh, that's nice. I like this is the idea. It's like kind of just too much in your head. It's just like same with the dance, the Sarah Shelton Mann performances. You know, it's like I wanted to get up and dance, or I wanted to like, I just, it impacted me in like every way for some reason.
All right. Well, let's have an interview. This is like the Maysoon's favorites episode. We're out here in beautiful Mills College in Oakland, California, speaking to Tarane Hemami, an artist, an arts organizer,
curator, educator.
I thought of a really silly question.
Okay. Those are my favorite.
Oh, good. Are Persian cats actually Persian?
I think they're all Persian. Yeah, every single Persian cat has to be Persian because that's what they're called.
All cats Persian?
All cats are Persian. All people are Persian.
Domestic cats did begin in the Middle East.
I think of Egypt when I think of cats.
That's what they say.
I think of Turkey, but okay, Persian cats.
I sent you an email a little while ago about this website you once posted maybe a number of years ago about how the language we use to talk about the Middle East changes depending on who's in power. Not necessarily in the Middle East, but who's writing about it. Like over the years, it's been called the Middle East, it's been called this or that. You know, Persians aren't Arabs. And so, or don't necessarily, you know, used to call if you say from, to someone from Iran, if, are you Arab? This whole thing kind of comes up. But I mean, I guess the question is like, what do you call that region? Do you call it the Middle East? Like, do you include Iran in that?
Yeah, it's been translated into Persian, and now so it's called Khavarmiyane, which is basically a translation of Middle East. But the term was not originated there, for sure. Yeah. I'm not an expert as to when it started being used. I think maybe middle of this century. I mean, last century. We're not in the middle of this century yet. Hopefully, everything by the middle of this century, all our problems are solved. But so usually, we talk about like middle of where? Middle East? it just doesn't make any sense whatsoever. But it's Iran is officially part of that region that is called Middle East. And we are, I don't know if Turkey is officially part of that. I don't think so. But now, it's
like... It's like Europe and the Middle East, or Europe and Asia. I feel like it has a confused identity.
It's also like Christian and Muslim and a lot of, it's fascinating place. But I don't think Turkey is, but if they are, then we're the only two countries that are non-Arabs.
I thought it was interesting listening to talks and interviews and stuff about your work, how your art practice has changed with the kind of changing political environment, like your piece, Hall of Reflections, how it started as just kind of like a community, like, talking to the Iranian people in the Bay Area, and then when 9/11 happened, how it kind of shifted your work?
Yeah, I mean, I'm fascinated by that myself, because I feel like it has completely taken a different shift since 9/11, and I think, I mean, if you're asking the question, how come or what happened, I guess it's the place I have found myself in, which is, this kind of question. Where is the Middle East? The curiosity about the region has risen, basically, since then. And a lot of, I've been approached by many different people to kind of answer questions that, we don't trust the media so much. And so I become that trusted person that people might ask a question to. And I think my work has become an extension of that. In some ways, explaining, and although, I don't know, explaining is a terrible way to talk about it, but it feels that way. I feel like I always need to create a context for the work to exist. And sometimes that context becomes the project itself. But it seems like the projects that I'm doing now are also direct result of 9/11, like what happened afterwards. And continuation of Hall of Reflection and the changes we've experienced. So, it was not my intention, but there it is. This is where I find myself.
What kind of work were you doing pre-9/11? I mean, how has that shifted? Or what sort of topics were you addressing at that point?
I think it was coming a lot more from a personal place. So even though my work dealt with identity issues and finding a place for myself in this country, right before 9/11, when the century shifted, I became a U.S. citizen, kind of after many, many years, and accepting that I'm here to stay. There's no home there for me to go back to, unfortunately. And a lot of the work had, was very much about being Iranian as well as being American and sort of finding myself in this in-between world. But I would call those my personal projects, and I've continued to do that. Since 9/11, kind of in between my collective projects or my community-based projects or research projects, however I'd like to call it, and it changes depending on who I'm talking to. But it's changed a lot. I think since graduate school, which goes back decades and decades ago, I started with sort of focusing on my personal narrative. Then it became about, how can I extend that to my community and bring them into the process, kind of believing in art as a tool of creating community and conversations. And so it shifted to a broader kind of identity issues. And now I'm collecting narratives of that have, and research projects that really look at the history of the region. And it's surprising to me that I'm doing this kind of projects. So I would have never guessed a decade ago this is where I would be.
I didn't realize that you've been working on some projects for a really long time, like your theory of survival piece, which I don't know how I didn't realize this, but like you've been working on this for so many years. I was like, oh my God, that's so awesome. Just like all these pieces are coming out of it every year or so. Can you talk a little bit about sort of the durational projects and what that means to you? And
like how you sustain that.
I do take breaks, I feel, you know. But often during those breaks, ideas develop that kind of continue the project. But also I'm always, during that break, I'm fundraising and, you know, trying to figure out how I'm going to do the next phase. So that's part of why it's taken so long. But it did, I think Theory of Survival Project actually connects to a couple other collective projects. So it goes back even further than that. So Hala Reflections, as you mentioned, I was collecting stories and photographs from the Iranian community, very specifically Bay Area. You know, this is our community, it's disappearing. This is before Facebook, so photographs were important. So I feel like the need for that project doesn't exist anymore. But it became very important, especially after 9/11, as I was actually gathering the stories. But then the personal stories were lacking kind of historical context. And so, and kind of like, what were people doing here? Because a lot of the stories were going back to the moment of migration. This is how I came here. This is what I'm doing now. But it didn't talk about what the community that has been here for over 50 years and some, you know, it goes back way further than that, but in large numbers, it came here since the CIA coup d'etat, 1953, basically. Yeah, so I was doing a collaborative project with Persis Karim, who's a writer, amazing woman in the Bay Area. She teaches at San Jose State University, right after 9/11, to collect the narratives. And the part of the Hala Reflection collection that was really amazing to us was the conversations that it allowed, you know, and it seemed very necessary and essential. And so we started a residency at Center for Art and Public Life at CCA and continued to bring people together for those conversations. And we actually focused on the artist community, like Iranian artist community. And at that time, we had a hard time coming up, like really, we had to do research to find people, came up with 25 people. I think today, if you actually try to do that, you're looking at a couple of hundred people to choose from. So it was a very different time. But we asked the community to bring archives of what they've been up to for the past 30 years. And so the archive that I'm working with Theory of Survival actually came through that project. Mm-hmm. So it all links back to 9/11 again. But the archive, Theory of Survival, belonged to an activist Iranian student group that was active from the, like, right after the CIA coup d'etat in 53 formation, like around 60s, all the way to after the revolution, 85. So that goes, you know, it's long time ago. But the reverberations of it we still feel in the region, in our local community, and definitely in Iranian history. And it's something that most Iranians don't know about, you know, that particular activist history. We've heard that history kind of from different voices and different groups, like the Islamic groups have turned that into their own history and so on. So this hasn't been documented. So it became a very important task for me. And so I've continued to work on that in different iterations.
What happened again? With all like the history and stuff, I've read Persepolis, so I know a little bit.
Of course. You didn't watch the movie? the book is better. So what are you talking about? The history of Iran? Okay, a good thing that you asked, my dear, because this is what I'm working on right now. because there are a lot of dark places in my historical knowledge. So this is what I'm working on. Please.
Well, that is a book.
It's a publication. It's like a newspaper, maybe 12 pages. It's taken its form after the many publications that were part of that archive. But I worked with California Institute for Integral Studies as a residence in their arts department, arts at CIS. And I worked towards bringing this collection of data together. And it's initially was supposed to be from 53, which is a big marker in Iranian history, the CIA coup d'etat, as I mentioned, to maybe the revolution, because that's the time period that the books and publication of Theory of Survival were published. But to understand that, I had to keep going back in history, and then to find out how it relates to what's happening now, I had to keep going forward to today. So this basically starts at the collection that we're putting together. It starts at like 1846, with the first contacts between Iran and outside of Iran, the English, the Russians, and so on, where all of the natural resources were basically being given away for pennies by our beloved kings at the time. And so it starts there for this timeline, and it continues till July with the Iran deal. So it kind of ends there. I feel like it's a good place. Hopefully that deal will go through. But anyway, it has a lot of information. And what I'm hoping to do with this is to actually create workshops where some of that history is easier addressed, and hopefully it's a place where conversations will begin. So what were you curious about now?
Let's see. Anything.
So 1953 is a big date. Prime Minister Mossadegh was deposed by the CIA. It was CIA's first operation, and they call it a very, cheap revolution because it only cost them, I think, $5 million. Like, it was ridiculous.
That's less than a movie.
I know, these days, right? But it was nothing. They just basically paid money to some newspaper writers, journalists, as well as thugs. And, they won a country. They won the oil. And they basically put a puppet government in place. Shah, Mohammad Reza Shah, was at the time 25 years old. He was just skiing in the Alps before that. did not think he had to. But that became a dictatorship that everybody wanted to depose. And there were a lot of political prisoners, and that we had our own CIA. Basically, SAVAK was created with the help of CIA and Israeli Secret Service, and it would be trained in Israel, sent back to Iran. And at that time, Israel and Iran were the only allies in the Middle East, basically. Mm-hmm. So it was a difficult period to have any kind of voice in Iran, and so the responsibility kind of fell on the students who were outside of Iran, and that became increasing number of students were coming out outside, some for political reasons, but mostly to, for education purposes. And they would come here and then for the first time maybe learn about the history, because of course what we learned in schools over there was all propaganda. So anti-Arab, it was just fascinating to go back and look at those languages, because that's also shifted and changed completely. But anyway, at the time of the revolution, or around early 70s, there were 50% of higher education students of Iran were studying outside of Iran. Wow. So that's a huge number. And so these groups became a real power. And they would basically, they were exposed to all this knowledge. They were at established universities. The group that I'm focusing on, which was based in Bay Area, Berkeley, had so many scholars, some of whom are teaching in universities. Now, they've continued to study the region and write about it and so on. And so that was the publications that I came across. But those materials, they translated heavily and wrote original essays and documented what was happening and smuggled information back and forth, basically. And so they became very active in sort of forming the political sensibility back in Iran as well. So some of this knowledge would be traveling back to Iran and back and forth. So fascinating time to be involved. And they basically were affected by all the anti-racist and anti-imperialist movements that were happening already here. They were real allies with other movements of dissent, especially South America, you know, Central America, but also Arab countries. And, you know, it's like you all of a sudden open the doors to truth. You're like, oh my God, I've been... It's fascinating. I'm always embarrassed to say, and it's good that we're now making it public, that I kind of refused to believe that for the longest time because, you know, I grew up with the American culture and the propaganda that we were reading. And even though I read heavily and I wanted the government of Iran to be deposed and everything, I still didn't believe everything that, like, about the CIA coup d'etat. You know, it's like, oh, come on, we blame our problems on other people. You know, that was my thing. Like, no, I'm sure it's all our own fault. And then you say, no, okay, 50 years later, it becomes public. It was true. But at the time, I didn't really trust the, like, opposition groups because there were a lot of inner fighting between the student groups right before the revolution and especially right after because everyone blamed each other. And then a lot of people went back to Iran and didn't make it back. They were either killed or, I mean, executed, killed in the streets or imprisoned. And so my generation, you know, it was pretty, for 10 years, we were kind of waiting for things to shift and change. And of course it didn't.
10 years after the revolution?
After the revolution, okay. Yeah.
My reading, I'm confused about like the revolution a little bit and that it turned from a monarchy basically into a theocracy, which to me does never, I'm like, when I think about that, I'm like, that's not, in my mind, that's not good. Like if I were in, I'm like, I'm pale. Oh God, I can't be like under some religious state. That would really not work out for me. And so wouldn't work out for me.
Especially as a woman.
Especially as a woman. And so I'm just trying to like, when I hear the word revolution, I think of like an uprising, but in like a progressive in a different direction.
Like Jefferson Airplane right. Revolution.
Well, so then that's why it's like, I'm like, I think
that
it's hard.
Background song to the revolution.
It's hard for me to a little bit to wrap my head around the Iranian revolution because it's like not like a revolution I'm used to reading about or thinking about.
But yeah. Don't you think we've kind of witnessed that in Egypt somewhat? I mean, we're seeing the struggles, you know?
Totally.
And this is what happened. So the Islamic groups and other student groups were working together for till I think early 70s, maybe a little bit before that. See, I've done all this research, but I would have to refer back to this. But to answer your question, so what happened was, of course, everybody bought into the idea that they wanted a popular uprising. Mm-hmm. And because Iranians were devout, like, you know, not in the major cities, but everywhere else. And they wanted this to be workers' revolution and everyday man's revolution and not just the intellectuals. So the intellectuals didn't want Islamic outcome. But they all kind of collectively decided to use Khomeini, and he had already been exiled to Iraq and then to France, like these are years right before the revolution, and had started a very much of a revolutionary for 30 years before that, and a head figure that was very respected in Iran as a, not as a leader of the country, but as a devout Muslim. He's an Ayatollah, you know, the highest ranking that you can be and educated and all of that. So he was supposed to be a symbol figure, and that's what he said, you know, that he has no interest in politics. And so everybody rallied behind him. Then basically it made millions came to the street. And the revolution succeeded. But then we had some interim governments, a real mess for a few months, and like women weren't supposed to be covered. Like all of that was still unknown. They call it the Spring of Freedom because it actually, everybody came out from underground activities thinking that they had freedom. They brought all the books and publications that is in my position. They were actually exchanged and sold in the streets and given away. And so all those hidden identities actually became revealed. So that's one thing that happened. But also Khomeini took power and remained in power and then gradually turned everything into... Well, they actually took the Islamic government to vote, and they claimed that 99% voted for Islamic Republic. But it's kind of sad, but maybe funny too, but sadly funny, that they people had two choices, Islamic Republic, yes or no. And it had to go.
Oh, God. What?
Like no other option. And also, it would you had to bring your... birth certificate, and they would mark it. So people were afraid of if they voted no, that would be marked. And so everybody voted yes, of course. I mean, you know, it's not a surprise. But anyway, that's what happened. And then what happened 6 months later is that they basically rounded up everyone who was in opposition, threw them in jail, killed, executions, right. And so on. And so basically that freedom spring lasted a spring, like one season. And then people tried to escape. And what happened immediately after the revolution, the war with Iraq started. So, of course, as we know, when there's a war, people rally behind the flag. And so that's what happened. 8 years. I guess the war could have been resolved a lot sooner than that, but the Islamic Republic kind of needed the war to establish themselves. So that went on. The country was devastated. They closed all the communication to the outside world. And yeah, just amazing. And changed the image of the country from a modern, you know, contemporary-looking country, because that was actually also another propaganda to make the country look a lot more modern than it was, to the Islamic image that we see now. The chador that covered the women became the symbol. That's the only image that was coming out of Iran, nothing else. You know, the journalists were kicked out. We were only seeing just chance of death to America. That's, I mean, to this day, we only see that pretty much. It's changed a little bit because of internet, but, you know, they've been very successful of controlling the image. Textbooks, money, you know, you name it. Everything was shifted, changed.
I think the West is sort of coming out of this a little bit, but there's, for such a long time, there's been this, like, terrible stereotype of Middle Eastern women, you know, being like submissive, not revolutionary, none of this. And I see you and your work, and like you're so incredibly revolutionary and powerful as a woman.
I don't consider myself a very strong woman. I know that I probably am. But I basically have grown up with so many amazing women, and that like Iranian women are just incredible, and people who have been part of this movement, especially, have been so impressive, and they're amazing. That I just, if I can do a little bit to reflect that, that would be, and that would be awesome, and just to have an opportunity to be in touch with them through this project, to have interviews and kind of talk about those changes that they've gone through as immigrants in this country, but also as revolutionaries, and as well as most of them academics and so on. It's something that I'm really looking forward to in the next year, hopefully. That's what I'll be doing. So a lot of it is focused on the women.
How has it been working with younger Iranian artists?
It's been a real gift. It's just been amazing to have the opportunity to work with these intergenerational and also intercultural, I can say, because even though they're Iranian, like we say Iranian, Iranian, Iranian-American, right now there's a real mix of generations that migrated here, like myself, at a later, you know, like I grew up in Iran and came here. to people who are about my age, but actually were born here, and younger, of course. And now, for a long time, we didn't have new immigrants coming in, because there were just no visas given to any students. And now, since 2009, we're getting a lot of Iranians coming through and getting coming for education. Has become okay again. Hillary Clinton said so in 2009, and it has happened. It's true. It's part of this. But it's fascinating. So anyway, those are, you know, these are young generation who grew up in, I mean, they were born after the revolution, and they grew up in the Islamic Republic and have come here. So that's a very different experience. And I have to say, I actually relate to the new immigrants a lot more than the people who were born here and grew up here, because it seems like we are going through similar experiences and struggles as like immigrants. Like that's one kinship, and then so anyway, it's fascinating. Like there are all these interplays of we have to explain ourselves to each other, which is amazing. But Iran also is producing such amazing group of artists, and they're coming from Iran, both here and in Iran. I would say it's been supported by a lot of the schools locally, so I'm grateful for that as well. You know, CCS, SFA, you look around, there have been this exchange happening now. And so a lot of these ideas, you know, these schools' ideologies is also traveling back to Iran. I'm always fascinated, like, how that is affecting over there. But I'm working with Iran, some of the students that were here are now back in Iran, and we're organizing together and so on. So that's also kind of learning about what's happening in Iran within its borders, as it's been kind of separated from everywhere else, is also... it's like a different art world. Yeah, it's soon going to be one and the same, but right now they have kind of an autonomy.
Do you think that art can affect social change?
I sure hope so, because otherwise all the work that I've been doing has been a total waste. I think, you know, I don't know if you can measure the change. But I think I can do as much as I can to affect my circle of people. Hopefully that will expand. And so, yeah, I'm a believer.
I love that. Well, thank you so much for kindly trekking out here. And as always, congratulations. From the bridge
to the other bridge
to the island in between, this has been
another episode
of Congratulations Pine Tree.